All right, everyone. Welcome to the show today, because we are diving deep into this case, and it's a real doozy. It kind of throws a wrench into how we think about free speech.
Yeah.
You know, online in the digital age.
Yeah.
So just imagine like getting blocked by the president on Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
And this isn't just some hypothetical.
Right.
This actually happened and, yeah, sparked a big legal battle, like one that has implications way beyond, you know, just one man's tweets.
Yeah, it is fascinating how Knight First Amendment Institute versus Trump, right? It really forces us to rethink these traditional legal concepts, like in the context of this rapidly changing digital landscape, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And on the surface, it seems so simple, right?
Right.
Someone sues because they got blocked on Twitter.
Yep.
But this wasn't just about, you know, hurt feelings or anything like that. This was a challenge to how government officials, you know, even the president, can interact with citizens in the online world.
Yeah, it gets to the heart of, you know, this question of, can a social media platform be a public forum, you know, one where the government can't discriminate based on viewpoint? And, you know, the court's decision in this case, it really does have the potential to, like, reshape the way officials at all levels engage with the public online.
So let's rewind a bit, set the stage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, remember Trump's Twitter?
Oh, yeah.
At Real Donald Trump.
Mm.
In the beginning, it felt very personal.
It did.
Like a peek into his unfiltered thoughts.
It was initially, you know, it was mostly personal opinions, you know, attacks on critics, these kinds of things.
Right.
However, as his political career progressed, right, so did his use of Twitter, you know.
Yeah.
It gradually transformed into a tool of governance.
Right. It went from coffee to, you know, actual policy pronouncements and, you know, international diplomacy playing out in 280 characters. And even firings announced on Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty wild.
And critically, you know, the Trump administration itself explicitly stated, you know, that his tweets should be considered official statements. That's a huge distinction legally, right? It blurs the lines between, like, personal musings and pronouncements from the president of the United States.
And this wasn't just about blocking any random internet troll.
No.
You know?
Yeah.
He was blocking people specifically for criticizing his policies.
Exactly. The people who brought this lawsuit, you know, they were citizens engaging in, like, the kind of back and forth dialogue that is, you know, supposed to be the bedrock of a democracy.
Right.
You know, they argued that they were being shut out of a space that had effectively become a digital town square, you know, a place for public discourse with their elected leader.
And that's where this public forum doctrine comes into play, right?
Exactly.
And I think for a lot of people, myself included, this is where things get a bit murky.
Yeah.
Can you break it down for us in plain English?
Of course. Essentially, the public forum doctrine says that certain spaces controlled by the government, whether physical or virtual, you know,
okay,
must be open for public expression. Think of like a classic town square where people can gather and share their opinions freely. You know, the question in Knight versus Trump was whether a Twitter account, a virtual space, right, could also be considered a public forum.
And in this case, the court said?
They said yes.
Really?
Trump's Twitter account in this particular instance was a designated public forum. And they base this on, you know, several factors. But the most important one is the interactive nature of the account.
So it wasn't just about Trump's own tweets, but the replies and the conversations that they sparked.
Exactly. The court recognized that replies to Trump's tweets, even though they were written by private citizens, right, were part of this designated public forum.
Mm-hmm.
And they compared it to, you know, a speaker's corner in a park.
Oh, okay.
Where anyone can come and voice their views, even views critical of the government.
Okay. That analogy makes sense. But how is that different from, say, someone moderating their own personal social media?
Right.
We all have the right to choose who we interact with online, right?
Right. That's where the concept of viewpoint discrimination becomes critical.
Hmm.
The court made a clear distinction between Trump's tweets, which they saw as government speech, and the replies to those tweets,
okay,
which were considered private speech happening within this newly established public forum.
Wait, so even though it's his account, what other people say in response is considered separate?
Precisely. It's a subtle but crucial point.
Okay.
The government can control its own speech,
right?
But it can't discriminate against your speech based on your viewpoint in a public forum.
So to use your analogy, it would be like kicking someone out of a town square meeting just for disagreeing with the mayor.
Exactly. The court argued that's essentially what Trump was doing by blocking critics on his Twitter. You know, it was viewpoint discrimination in a space deemed a public forum.
Wow. Okay. So, okay. That makes the legal reasoning a bit clearer. But, let's talk about, you know, what this means for the average person, you know, scrolling through Twitter. Does this ruling mean, like, I can go toe-to-toe with my senator online?
Yeah.
And they can't block me even if they just, like, hate my takes?
It essentially boils down to that, yes, this case really reinforces the idea that you as a citizen have the right to engage in, you know, online discourse with your government.
Okay.
And that includes criticizing elected officials, you know, even the president.
So if I see, like, my mayor tweeting about, you know, a new park proposal, I can just reply with, like, all my concerns. And they can't just, like, shut me down because they don't like what I have to say.
Exactly. This ruling sets a precedent that they can't block you simply because they disagree with your viewpoint. Of course, as we touched on earlier, you know, there are limits.
Right.
If your reply is truly harassing or contains, you know, genuinely offensive content, that's a different story.
Right. Because there's a big difference between, you know, expressing a dissenting opinion.
Right.
And being abusive or threatening.
Right.
It seems like this case tries to strike a balance between, you know, protecting free speech and allowing for reasonable moderation.
Mm-hmm. You've hit the nail on the head. This case highlights, you know, the constant struggle to find that sweet spot between protecting free speech and preventing, you know, harmful online behavior. Mm-hmm. And it provides some clarity, you know, but it also raises a ton of new questions.
Sure.
What about other platforms like Facebook or Instagram?
Right.
Do the same rules apply?
It's true, because officials use those platforms in much the same way, right?
Absolutely. And what about even more subtle ways of controlling online speech, like algorithms that prioritize certain viewpoints over others, you know?
Yeah.
We're still grappling with the implications of these technologies and how they impact, you know, the public discourse.
That's a really good point. It feels like this case is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to, you know, this whole debate about digital free speech.
It really is. You know, Knight versus Trump was a significant step, but there's a long way to go. And it's not just about legal precedents, you know, it's about promoting a culture of open and respectful dialogue, you know, even when, or perhaps especially when we disagree.
So what's your advice for public officials navigating this new landscape? How can they use social media effectively without running afoul of the First Amendment?
I think the biggest takeaway is the need for a clear separation between personal and official accounts. You know, if you're using an account to conduct government business, you need to treat it like a public forum. You know, be ready for dissenting opinions.
Okay.
And resist the urge to silence those voices just because they're critical.
So think twice before hitting that block button.
Precisely. And remember, if you do need to moderate content, make sure it's done in a way that doesn't target, you know, specific viewpoints. Focus on objectively offensive content like threats or hate speech, not just opinions you disagree with.
That's good advice for anyone online, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's so easy to get caught up in the heat of the moment. But we should all be working to create spaces where different perspectives can be shared respectfully.
I couldn't agree more often. The best response to speech you dislike isn't to silence it, but to engage with it. You know, debate, offer alternative perspectives, but keep the conversation going.
Okay, so we've talked about Knight versus Trump, the public forum doctrine, viewpoint discrimination, and what this all means for, you know, both public officials and everyday citizens. It's a lot to unpack.
It is. But before we wrap up this part of the discussion, I want to throw out a hypothetical, especially for our legally minded listeners. Let's say a mayor is posting about a new policy on their official Facebook page and starts deleting comments that are critical of the policy.
Okay.
Even though they aren't abusive or offensive, is that constitutional?
Ooh, that's a tricky one. Sounds like it could potentially be a problem, but it's definitely a gray area. I'll let our listeners ponder that one.
It really highlights those gray areas we still need to figure out in this ever-evolving digital landscape.
And speaking of gray areas, mm-hmm. you know, this whole case was about blocking. But what about those less obvious ways of controlling online speech, like algorithms that prioritize certain types of content or shadow banning, where people don't even know they're being silenced?
That's a great point and a critical piece of the puzzle. This case was a victory for free speech, but it's clear this fight is far from over. You know, we're only beginning to understand the power these technologies have to shape what we see and hear online. It's a conversation we need to keep having.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. We've been going deep on this landmark case, Knight First Amendment Institute versus Trump, and its impact on free speech, you know, in this digital age. And it seems like every layer we peel back just, you know, reveals even more complex questions.
Yeah, it really does. We've seen how something like as seemingly simple as like blocking someone on Twitter can just open up like this Pandora's box of constitutional issues. You know,
yeah.
It's forcing us to rethink like what even constitutes a public forum, right? And where the boundaries of government speech even lie and how to protect free speech in, you know, this rapidly evolving digital world.
Right. We started by looking at how Trump's use of Twitter, you know, evolved from like personal to official and kind of blurred those lines and ultimately, you know, landed him in legal trouble.
Right.
And then we explored how the court applied this public form doctrine to social media, which is something I bet most people never considered before this.
Yeah, and we can't forget that key distinction, you know, between government speech and the speech of, you know, private citizens happening within that public forum. And that's crucial for understanding why, you know, blocking people based on their viewpoint is, you know, a no-go for government officials. It's like silencing dissent, which is a huge red flag in a democracy.
Absolutely. So Knight versus Trump offers some much-needed clarity, but as we've been discussing, it also throws a whole bunch of new questions our way.
Exactly. It's like opening one door only to find 10 more behind it, right?
Yeah.
We touched on the challenges of separating personal and official accounts, you know, how these principles might apply to other platforms like Facebook and Instagram, and that looming question of like how algorithms impact what we even see online.
Yeah, it feels like every answer just leads to more questions, which I guess keeps things interesting for us, right?
It certainly does. And, you know, while this particular case focused on, you know, the actions of a president, you know, its ripple effects are being felt far beyond the Oval Office. You know, this is relevant to anyone who uses social media to engage with their government, whether it's your local school board, you know, state representatives or federal agencies.
This is about your right as a citizen to be heard, to participate in public discourse, you know, to hold your elected officials accountable. And on the flip side, it's about, you know, those officials fostering, you know, open and inclusive dialogue, even when faced with criticism.
Yeah, it's a two-way street. Mm-hmm. This case really highlights the delicate balance we need to find between protecting free speech and ensuring, you know, responsible behavior online. It's an ongoing conversation.
So what does this all mean for our listeners out there, you know, in the digital world? What can they do to make sure their voices are heard? And what should they expect from their government officials online?
First and foremost, you know, stay informed, understand your rights, be aware of, you know, these legal precedents, and keep up with the evolving debates around digital free speech. You know, knowledge is power.
Right. Don't be afraid to speak your mind, engage in civil discourse, and, you know, challenge ideas you disagree with. But like Spider-Man taught us, you know, with great power comes great responsibility.
Right.
You know, be respectful. Even when you disagree, focus on the substance of the argument, mm-hmm. not personal attacks.
Absolutely. And remember, if you encounter, you know, genuinely abusive or harassing behavior, don't hesitate to report it. These platforms have mechanisms in place to deal with that.
Yeah, it's a collective effort. We all have a part to play in creating a digital space where diverse viewpoints can coexist, open and honest dialogue is encouraged, and the principles of free speech are upheld.
Cases like Knight versus Trump, while imperfect, provide valuable guideposts. You know, for this journey, they remind us of how crucial it is to stay vigilant and engaged when it comes to protecting our rights in the digital age.
Well said. This has been a fascinating deep dive into a topic that I think, you know, we'll be grappling with for years to come.
It's been a pleasure exploring this with you and our listeners.
Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive. We encourage you to continue the conversation, share your thoughts and insights, and keep fighting for your right to be heard online. Until next time, keep learning, keep questioning, and keep those voices loud and clear.